So Gopalachari has some questions, and if others have questions, if there's time, you can discuss them also. Please go ahead. And please don't keep Shriya Shapanishad at your feet. Keep it on your head is better.
So there's this mantra number 10 of Sri Shapanishad. Prabhupada gives the 18 points of the culture of knowledge, and one is that one shouldn't become a source of anxiety to others by the actions of his body, by the thoughts of his mind, or by his words.
Anad vega karangva kyam is Bhagavad Gita. Yeah.
So my question is that sometimes while preaching, our preaching is harsh experience to the receivers of the knowledge. And
one should not give anxiety to others. Yeah, what's the exact word? Srila Prabhupada. Which point is it?
The third one.
Point number three.
So my part of the question is whether does it refer just to our own actions, which are not maybe based in Sadhu Gurus and Shastra, whereas the actions of which are based...
Yeah, this is... actually it's from chapter 13 of the Bhagavad Gita. Yeah, these are... Bhagavad Gita? Can we get that, please? These are basic principles of human behavior by which one can become eligible for attaining spiritual knowledge. So let's just read out the Sanskrit. And here in this purport to Mantra 10 of Sri Shupanishad, Srila Prabhupada has given it in a more elaborate way. And here in the Bhagavad Gita as it is, Srila Prabhupada gives it in a succinct manner. So, let's see how that corresponds. Non-violence, it seems to be... it's a free translation. Srila Prabhupada has given. Anyway, I'll read out all the points in English. Krishna summarizes them by saying, Etaj Gyanam Iti Proktam. All of these factors, they constitute knowledge. So Krishna says, humility, pridelessness, non-violence, tolerance, simplicity, approaching a bona fide spiritual master, cleanliness, steadiness, self-control, renunciation of the objects of sense gratification, absence of false ego, the perception of the evil of birth, death, old age and disease, detachment, freedom from entanglement with children, wife, home and the rest, even-mindedness amid pleasant and unpleasant events, constant and unalloyed devotion to me, aspiring to live in a solitary place, detachment from the general mass of people, accepting the importance of self-realization, and philosophical search for the absolute truth, all these I declare to be knowledge, and besides this, whatever there may be is ignorance. And Srila Prabhupada, drawing from this, states, one should not become a source of anxiety to others by the actions of his body, by the thoughts of his mind, or by his words. So here, Lord, from the text from Gita, which Srila Prabhupada has translated with commentary, Lord Krishna is giving the basic principles necessary to cultivate knowledge. Now, preaching Krishna consciousness is something else. That means giving knowledge, transcendental knowledge. Now, this is similar to Srila Prabhupada's comment on the well-known, or at least until recently in India, well-known term from Manu Samhita, that satyam bruyat priyam bruyat ma bruyat apriyam satyam, that one should speak the truth and one should speak pleasantly, and one should not even speak the truth if it is unpleasant. So the idea is that one shouldn't be overly harsh, or just like in Bengali culture, I said in this book, this Glimpses of Traditional Indian Life, I've explained how in Bengali culture, it's often people speak in euphemisms or in a roundabout way, and just like a senior may call a junior and say, well, instead of saying, look, hey, you're going out and boozing at night, isn't it? They'd say something like, well, I've heard people have been saying something about you, and they'll say, to just kind of gently introduce it, and the idea is not to upset the person and let them, give them a chance to explain themselves rather than just punching in the face. And British culture is like that in comparison to, say, American. It's more like, yeah, more, you could say, they speak in a softer, less direct and straightforward way. But Srila Prabhupada, commenting on this, he said that in the matter of preaching the absolute truth, this consideration isn't there. In ordinary social dealings, this applies, but in preaching the absolute truth, this doesn't apply. One should speak the truth clearly as it is. Now, in yet another place, Srila Prabhupada said that this is specifically for the guru to the disciple. He shouldn't beat around the bush with him. If you know what that means, beat around the bush, it means like that. Not saying directly, but indirectly. He should say very clearly. Although in the modern age, I mean, in the present generation, we often find that gurus have to deal with their disciples very carefully, otherwise disciples will say, forget you, had enough. I'll go and find out a better guru who satisfies my senses. So if someone asks for advice, and if the advice is, they don't like it, they'll make a campaign against you on the internet or something. So, but the actual, in propagating the absolute truth, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur said that the method of delineation or explanation should be as clear and unambiguous as possible without consideration of time, place, or circumstance. This is the best way, the manner that he suggested, or not suggested, or said that preaching should be done, and he very much followed this principle himself also. Srila Prabhupada was more circumspect. He was a little, not much more, but he advised that you can say anything, but you have to be very, at least Jayavitaka Maharaj quoted this, I've often heard him quote this, that you can say anything, but you should think very carefully before putting it into print. But in Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati's time, that of course nowadays what you say, it can be recorded, and so you have to be careful also. But in the Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's time, they had no qualms about naming names and criticizing people right in their magazine. They do philosophy. They wouldn't just use a load of heavy terms, but they'd explain philosophically why. So in general, that one shouldn't, it's not for one's own sake, one should not be envious. This is the point. I believe this point number three is that Srila Prabhupada said one should not put others into anxiety, be a mind, body, or words. This corresponds to the third principle in which Lord Krishna explains here in Bhagavad Gita, ahimsa, non-violence. So one should not put others into anxiety, but for the sake of preaching Krishna consciousness, for giving them the truth by which they'll be delivered from all anxiety, oh, it may be necessary to, it's often necessary to speak in such a way that people do feel disturbed. But that's not violence. Rather, not to speak Krishna consciousness, that's also Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's definition of violence is not to preach Krishna consciousness. The real non-violence means to preach Krishna consciousness. It's just like the surgeon. His failure to use the knife when it should be used for surgical reasons, for surgery, his refusing to do so, I don't want to hurt, it'll leave a scar. Well, that's violence. If necessary, one has to, or the police, their failure to apprehend criminals is violence on the whole of society. If you think, well, let's be nice to this criminal and let him off, and then he'll just go and do more violence and more harm. So this is why this whole issue of the annotations to Srila Prabhupada's books, this controversial issue which came up recently, it jogged me into thinking that yes, actually we need annotations, not just annotations on a few points, but full-fledged commentaries on all of Prabhupada's books. And because many statements are to be understood in context. And more background can be given from the commentaries of the acharyas. Prabhupada has taken from the acharyas. Anyway, I spoke about this at length yesterday in London about Srila Prabhupada's commentaries. They're the most important commentary for the whole of Kali Yuga, and every important commentary has sub-commentaries. So Srila Prabhupada's books, as Srila Prabhupada said, my disciples will write purports on my purport, so it's about time that some systematic effort, some effort is made to make systematic comments and explanations on Srila Prabhupada's books in the parampara method, because already it's going on in all kinds of things are being extrapolated out of Prabhupada's words, so it's time to make a commentary as it is. The next line in Parampara. It's actually a very important part of the Parampara. It's not simply giving initiation, but it's all the major acharyas we find who in the list of acharyas given in the beginning of Bhagavad Gita as it is, there have been many, many gurus in Gaudiya Vaishnavism, but those who are mentioned are those who have made significant, not only preaching contributions, but significant literary contributions and philosophical contributions, defining and establishing the parampara. So that needs to be done, because at the present times, so shortly after Srila Prabhupada's disappearance, there's so many different opinions on what Srila Prabhupada taught that practically no one respects what Srila Prabhupada says, because they just think, well, it's just something to interpret in your own way. Prabhupada said that, but, the famous word, but. So it requires that things be put in order, unless Srila Prabhupada's words just simply go on being misinterpreted and reinterpreted or just neglected altogether. And then it'll be up to, then some will accept and some won't. It's inevitable there will be different opinions about what Srila Prabhupada said, and there will be schisms and splits and factions. So, it is required to establish that, the process of understanding as it is in parampara, which is getting lost in the in a haze and a maze of all kinds of imaginary ideas. I was just seeing all those, I mean, I didn't look at them, all those psychology books, and I was just thinking, we've got so much of our, you know, in our own tradition to study, that, it's, you know, getting, it's like a diversion. I don't know what you think, it's not you, it's your wife. Anyway, that's what I feel, that when we do have access to this highest, most wonderful knowledge, then to get diverted into other things is, it's a diversion, or to become overly fascinated by other things. Not that there's no room within the Krishna conscious movement for psychology, astrology, even Reiki. It's not that there's no room for it. I mean, it can be, but to get to become fascinated by some other worldview means that instead of seeing the world through the eyes of Krishna consciousness, if we associate so much with non-devotees by reading their books, and we start to think in the way they think, and we start to see the world through the eyes of psychology or Reiki or astrology or something which is different to the eyes of knowledge given by Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra. Another thing I was thinking about psychology is that it's a new science, and it is necessary for the crazy society spawned by industrialism and consumerism. It's literally driving people crazy. Otherwise it wasn't required. Not that there weren't crazy people prior to industrialism, but it wasn't like every other person was mentally imbalanced. And I actually saw that traveling for years in the villages of Bangladesh. You didn't come up. The words for depression, boredom, there's no such words. For depression you could say there are vishad, nirasha, but it's like a state that one may enter, not like a chronic condition that takes over the lives of literally thousands and maybe millions of people. And probably crazy people, yeah, I saw crazy people also, but they're just, you know, they're crazy, and there's a few of them, and they just, those who are really crazy, just, you know, they get fed, and people don't bother too much about them. Another reason why people are crazy, I mean, there may be many reasons, but we say industrialism and all the false hopes and the unstable society, but another reason is that people are performing so much, there's so much sinful activity. And one of the karmic reactions to mass animal slaughter is craziness. It's just another reaction. Okay, what's another question? Or do you want to discuss that more?
Maybe someone has a question.
You
cannot be use some things like in Yuktavaraya, like some tips from psychology. Like
you can use, but in psychology, it's not just some tips. It's a whole way of seeing the world.
It's also, if someone is a psychologist.
If someone's a psychologist, yeah. If you already have it,
then people take them.
Yeah, but on the other hand, you have to see that psychology is a highly speculative science, or so-called. They call it a science, but there are different. Within psychology itself, there are completely different ways, methods and systems in modern psychology. And therefore, it can't be said to be that they've really got their act down. And they certainly have certain presumptions which go against the Krishna conscious understanding. For instance, they don't accept that it's due to karmic reactions that we inherit. Karanam guna sango sya sadasadyoni janmasu utkramantam stitangvapi bunjanam vagunanvitam vimuhananu pashanti. Pashanti Gyana Chakshusha. They don't have the eye of knowledge to see that we get different bodies and the minds that go with it due to karmic reactions. So, I mean, it's based on ignorance, actually. And then and there are also certain presumptions which go against the Vedic worldview. Just like that... Well, it's generally considered that all people and all races, they're all equal. But that's not the Vedic worldview. The people born in India are more pious. So, no doubt there are some useful things there, but one, you know, but the tendency to pick up all kinds of wrong ideas and not to be able to sort out the useful things from the non-useful things. I mean, generally we see that devotees who get into this, they get sidetracked. They can't keep their clear vision, and they tend to think that we need all these kind of things, and then we can chant Hare Krishna properly. When we get first of all, we have to get sorted out mentally, and it's not just psychology. First of all, with Reiki or get your chakras sorted out, and this and then you can chant Hare Krishna properly. But that is not the teaching of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. His teaching is Hare Nama, Hare Nama, Hare Nama, Eva Kevalam, Kalona, Streva, Nasceva, Nasceva, Gatir, Anyata. Even the general standard Vedic process won't work, so what to speak of speculative psychology? Everyone should just, chanting Hare Krishna is the way. Yoga won't work. Other things won't work. So you could say, yeah, you can do that, you can do some psychology and then, but there's so many things you could do for self-improvement. You could do, you know, water treatment therapy and magnetotherapy, and there are billions of things. There's all kinds of ideas to make yourself better, but it's not yourself. So it may make you feel good or this and that, but if we become... And there's, I mean, there's, if someone wants to do some magnetotherapy, we're not going to... You know, throw them from the top of a tall building, but getting fascinated by all these things and thinking that they have something so valuable to offer, and then getting absorbed in them. I mean, to study psychology takes such a big effort. If someone's already has some degree in that, well, all right. It might be of some use, although probably if you come back 20 years later, all the things that they're teaching and attempting to apply on people will be superseded by some new theories of psychology. So how scientific it is highly questionable. But really the method to deliver us from this crazy age is chanting the holy names. And hearing Srimad Bhagavatam. So it's not a substitute. It tends to be a diversion. And like I say, they have all kinds of presumptions that about how we should behave. Just like this point of Prabhupada, he would speak very strongly. And that's considered to be very wrong in the New Age way of thinking, that you should speak very strongly. And it's practically become, in ISKCON, it's become practically taboo to speak very strongly, as Srila Prabhupada did. And to say out front that this is rascaldom, or this is nonsense. That means if we can't speak like that, or if we think there's something wrong with speaking like that, then it's deviation from what Srila Prabhupada gave us. And there's also I see it within our society today, there's very strongly this idea, it's kind of morphed into the way of thinking of devotees, that, well, you should always, it's not that person's fault, and if they did something wrong, it's not really their fault, but Shastra teaches us that if we do something wrong, it is our fault. In the modern age, they say, well, it's because he was beaten by his father in his childhood, or, you know, he didn't get enough bananas when he was a kid, or whatever. He was deprived. But the Vedic teachings teach us that ultimately we are responsible for everything that comes to us. And the Vedic teachings are that we should think that if something unpleasant happens to me, it is ultimately it's my fault. It's because of sinful actions that I've done either in this life or in previous lives. So this tendency to put the blame, that no one's to blame for anything. But that's not the Vedic system of understanding. We are to blame. We got this body and we have the opportunity to do right or do wrong. And if we do right, we get the result. And if we do wrong, then we can't blame anyone else. Yes, please.
Right, you're saying that we should always feel that whatever happens to us, whatever anyone does to us, we're to blame ultimately.
That's how we should think. Yeah, that's. I'll just quote the verse on this because it's a famous verse, and Srila Prabhupada said that this should be the guide of all devotees. You know that verse, right? Tatenu kampan susamikshamano bhunjana evatma kritang vipakang vidvagvapu bhivedatam namaste. Jiveta yo muktipade sadaya bhag. Lord Brahma says that, addressing Krishna, says that one who considers that whatever is happening to me is simply due to my past activities and tolerates whatever difficulties come along thinking like this, but at the same time thinking it's my sinful reactions, but nevertheless, without being disturbed by that, goes on serving Krishna with mind, body and word, such a person is guaranteed to go back to Godhead. So that's the attitude of a devotee. Yes, please.
So, if the devotees are very tolerant like that, then what if someone who's more senior also does something wrong?
Yeah.
Is responsible for doing something wrong in terms of treating someone wrongly or
using Yes, it is. There is also misuse of position. One may also see that someone in position is misusing that position, abusing that position. That this attitude doesn't mean that one should tolerate nonsense in others. So if it's seen that a position is being seriously abused, I mean, to some extent, those in positions of authority, they have to wield that authority, and those who are in a subordinate position, they can't complain about that. And I mean, that's the rule of the world. For all these ideas of everyone's equal, no one's equal. If you join the army, no one's equal. You join a company, you're not on the same level as the boss or even the supervisor. So the position of the supervisor has to be respected, even if he's, not the most empathetic kind of person. But he has that position, you have to respect it. But if he seriously misuses that, then that should be reported also. It doesn't, that one should consider that my suffering is due to my past sinful reactions doesn't mean that seriously substandard behavior should go unchecked. seriously substandard behavior of others. Yeah.
Maharaj, just in relation to Gopal's Guru's question on about not being a cause of anxiety when preaching to others, and you give some comments in relation to that. I was also thinking of the incident in Chaitanya Bhagavat where Lord Chaitanya is meeting with Keshav Kashmir.
Yeah.
And it said that Lord Chaitanya, he said that the Lord would not tolerate anyone's pride, and but still he took him to like a secluded place, and there he very mentions the word gently, he very gently defeated him.
Well, he humiliated him actually in front of all his Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's students, but then he spoke with him very politely, having done so. But actually, he did humiliate him. First, I mean, his intention, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's intention wasn't to so much to humiliate Keshav Kashmiri as to deflate his pride. But the two things go simultaneously. And he was going on with his world conquering in a very proud mood, and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu didn't do it in front of a big assembly, but he did in front of all his students. And
he also chastised them when they started to laugh at him.
Yeah. So he kept it. The point is that he did what was required to help that person come to a better understanding. He didn't rub it in, so to speak.
I was just going to add to that, there's a few statements just at the end of that.
Another consideration is how humble was Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was in his behavior towards the Mayavadis at Varanasi. But then when it came to, they weren't even willing to listen to him. They thought he was just some kind of vagabond jumping around the streets pretending to be a sannyasi. But then he got their attention by his humility and by his good behavior and by his exhibiting an effulgence. So they realized, ooh, this is someone special. But then when it came to discussion, he pointed out very clearly that all your theories are all bogus. So it's not that we always do, and Srila Prabhupada didn't always deal very strongly with people, but he often did. And sometimes they became disturbed and went away. It's a risk in preaching. But on other occasions, that bubble of complacency and egoism, if by speaking gently, it won't be pricked. But if you can, by strong words, if you can cut right through that, it may save them millions of lifetimes of just floating on the mental platform. If you just, someone comes and thinks, I'm a very big philosopher, and you discuss with them philosophically, and they go away thinking you're very nice, but still thinking, I know so much, how did that benefit them? There's one incident that Ravindra Swarup Prabhu brought, he was at university at the time, and he brought one of his professors to meet Prabhupada, and Prabhupada was just extremely heavy with him. And the man left enraged. So it doesn't seem like very good PR, and it doesn't look like, didn't seem like Prabhupada benefited that person by being so strong with him. Because he asked the man, what are you teaching? And the man said, Hinduism. He said, what do you mean? Then Prabhupada asked him, what do you mean by Hinduism? And he gave his clever reply, I don't know. And Prabhupada turned to Srup Damodar, he was Srup Damodar Brahmachari at the time, and said to him, what do you call a person who purports to teach something that he doesn't know? And Srup Damodar Prabhu at the time, took up the cue and said, Achita Prabhupada. So Prabhupada said, you see, he is also a PhD. He has given the verdict on you. You are a cheetah. And that was the beginning of the conversation. And it continued in that vein. It didn't last very long. So this man, you know, he became enraged, and he felt severely insulted. But actually, he was from a Vallabh Sampradaya background. He was from India, although he had become a puffed up Mayavadi. But later on, he thought about what Prabhupada had said, and he went back to his Vallabh Vaishnav Sampradaya roots, and he understood that Prabhupada was right, actually. It may not always happen. Prabhupada called a hippie onto the stage in front of thousands of people in Delhi and had a shouting match with him, and many people left. They thought, why is this Swami becoming so angry, unnecessarily? But for those who understood the purport, Prabhupada was pointing out that he had just been making the point in his lecture that you have to hear from a guru, and he was pointing out that this is not this method of challenge that the hippie had, this is not the way to hear. So it's not for everyone, and it's not in every circumstance, but it's not necessarily true that we always have this so-called niceness. This is what the mundane people indulge in, this. They're so-called nice to each other, but their so-called niceness is just a cushion to keep them separate from each other without coming very close and just overlooking all the... It's I scratch your back, you scratch mine kind of thing. I'm okay, you're okay. But Srila Prabhupada was personal. That's why he often wielded the sword of knowledge, and it hurts. But that surgery that can get through millions of lifetimes of egoism. There are so many examples of that.
Could be a way to do it without giving fear to people.
Without giving fear to people?
Like religion.
Well, without hurting? Well, no, getting the egoism hurts. Fear?
To hell or something like that.
Well, I don't see that Srila Prabhupada often preach like that, exactly, but he would, just like this, he called a man a cheetah, and there are so many examples. Someone stood up and said, I am God, and Prabhupada said, you are not God, you are dog. So he could have said, well, that's a very interesting proposition, let's discuss that. And what are the six qualities of God, and do you have them? No. Prabhupada could have addressed it in a philosophical manner. But on this occasion, he chose not to. He said, you're not God, you're a dog. Another occasion, when someone presented himself as God, Srila Prabhupada said, he said, I offer you my respects, now sit down. So sit down and be quiet, like this. So he just humiliated the person by showing he's so insignificant. So if one is acting to give Krishna consciousness to others, not out of egoism, trying to show I'm better than you, then Krishna will give the intelligence. How to speak, what to say. But this idea that we always be nice and smile at others, and a sadhu is one who holds a flower and smiles, that's not the version of Srimad Bhagavatam. Bhagavatam says, what is that verse? I'm always forgetting that. This Tato Du Sangha. What is that? Tato Du Sangha. Varjanam, Dusta, Satsu Sajeta Buddhiman, Santa Evasya Chindanti Manovya Sangam Uktubihi. Which means that one should give up bad association, an intelligent person should give up bad Tatozu Sangam Utsrija. An intelligent person should give up bad association and associate with sadhus. And who are sadhus? Sadhus are the persons who, by their words, they cut all the attachments within the mind by their sharp words. That's why Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, he defines sadhu according to this verse as one who cuts. Otherwise, you'll find in India there are so many nice speakers, they'll speak nice stories, and everyone will say, oh, very nice, and such nice bhakti. But then they have a nice feeling, but they're carrying it around their material attachments, which separate them from Krishna. Yeah, anything else, please? Yes.
Maharaj, could you say something about during the time of the Christian Inquisition, they had...
You've been looking at that book on the Inquisition?
I read it before, yeah.
Yeah. Well, that was over a period of a few hundred years. It only recently closed down, actually, right? Officially. It was only officially disbanded when? Late 19th century or something?
Yeah.
Anyway. I hope there's something Krishna conscious in this question. Well, it's not really our line talking about the Inquisition.
Well, the thing that intrigues me about it is how people from the same faith would sort of kill one another.
Why should they kill one another? Well, that's in Bhagavad Gita also, isn't it? I mean, they're both... Nowadays we'd say that both Yudhishthira and Duryodhana were Hindus, although no such word had been invented at the time. They're both followers of the Varnashram system. Well, why Christians would kill each other, it's a religious system in the mode of ignorance. And from the mode of ignorance, you can't expect enlightened behavior. That's a simple answer, but it covers it.
The specific detail, though, of deeming a person a heretic, like there was some deviation in philosophy, and then they would burn the person or torture them and burn them. So,
I think the answer that is a mode, it's a spawned of the mode of ignorance that covers all of it. It's a religion in which they have no clear idea of God. They make the gross mistake of identifying Jesus with God. They say that Jesus is God and then he was killed, which is that's a major heresy in itself. It's like atheism to say that God can be killed. They've invented this idea of Satan, who's a competitor to God, and slaughter of animals is it's almost like a tenet of Christianity. So what can you expect from such a tamasic religious system? Some good things are there also, no doubt. The belief in God, however strange it may be, their idea of God, and then they have the whole cult of the Virgin Mary, which is nothing to do with what Jesus or any of the prophets taught. It's just something that came up later. So there's so many strange things, but still, even then, just the idea of belief in a supreme being, however vague and misunderstood it is, that's good. But because they have no clear knowledge, therefore they indulged in mass killing. And we're not even necessarily against that. It's just that Arjuna was exhorted by Krishna to kill Duryodhana and to fight in the battle. So there is a place for mass violence, but that should be... One should understand on what grounds it is acceptable.
I was just trying to tie that point to like what are the boundaries, like Gopal Prabhu was talking about not being a cause of anxiety to others when preaching, and Rukmini Prabhu was talking about not being a source of fear. So at what point are you preaching to someone the truth? Does that become like violence or aggression? Or
no, when one has the motive to give others Krishna consciousness and is trained in the philosophy of doing so, then that is never harmful. The endeavor to spread Krishna consciousness by the methods ordained by the acharyas is never harmful. Even though the person may feel I'm being harmed, or because of you, because of this Krishna consciousness, you spoiled our family life. My wife started chanting Hare Krishna and stopped eating meat. So someone may see that as very harmful, although it's actually most beneficial. But due to their ignorance, they can't appreciate that. So, benefit means, or to act for the benefit of others, means to attempt to bring them up from their lower consciousness to Krishna consciousness. But due to their lower consciousness, they consider that as violence or unpleasant. Just like Indra thought when he became a pig, he thought, why are they calling me to be Indra? I'm quite happy here as a pig. So that's the consciousness of someone who doesn't want to be disturbed in the mode of ignorance. Can you understand? It didn't seem to be that difficult to understand. To reinforce someone's foolish sense of complacency, which will cause them to take birth again and again and again, suffering in this material world, that is not being nice. People think it's nice. Good day, how are you? Fine, thank you. To reinforce their mistaken self-identity, that is not being kind to others. To break that, to burst that bubble and give people the knowledge of their true position in relation to Krishna, that is nice. Although to them it may appear as harmful or unpleasant. Is it very difficult to understand?
That point's not difficult to understand, but for example, Lord Kapila Dev talks about devotees who are people who render devotional service in the mode of ignorance, and one of the qualities is they're violent to others. Mm. So if someone, let's consider a scenario where someone in that consciousness, where a Kanishtha devotee who's violent and who's preaching.
Yeah, I saw this once. This was quite a long time ago. I think it was in Stratford-on-Avon in England. We were on book distribution. I was side by side with someone who's a disciple of Srila Prabhupada. At that time, he was mostly disciples of Prabhupada in the movement, although Prabhupada had passed away at that time. So he was distributing books, and then we were just going out for one day. I was visiting England, actually. I was already based in India at that time. So we drove up, and then one man spoke to him somewhat challengingly and said, "Well, I think Shiva's supreme." I just heard this, and I went on with my book distribution. About 2 minutes later, I saw this devotee physically assaulting this man. The voice level rose quite rapidly, and then this man got the devotee assaulted that man, and who walked off saying, "Ha, Krishna conscious, love and peace, ha." So he wasn't the devotee wasn't able to deal with his haughtiness and his challenge in a manner other than starting to beat him. I mean, on your program, you meet you're upfront preachers, and you meet all kinds of people all the time, right? So you wouldn't have done that. So interestingly, so that's an example of how not of unwanted aggression, apparently in Krishna consciousness. Interesting that that devotee later became a full-fledged, quite a few years later, when the Ritvigvad came up, he became a full-fledged Ritvigvadi, and his main thing was to go around and tell people, tell all the bad things that ISKCON's doing with, in a very aggressive style. Interesting, huh? This Ritvik propaganda too, their whole thing is just to very aggressively and illogically point out all the faults in ISKCON and some more too. And they think this is their service to humanity. But it doesn't help anyone advance in Krishna consciousness. It just makes people think that, well, everything in ISKCON is wrong. And I agree, there are lots of things wrong, but they're simply pointing out this is wrong, that's wrong, and as their whole, and it seems to be their whole and sole endeavor. I mean, if they're back to God, what is it? No, back to Prabhupada. If it's actually back to Prabhupada, it should be full of talk of Krishna, because Prabhupada was always talking of Krishna. And Prabhupada lived in an ISKCON which was full of many faults, and he didn't fail to deal with them, but he did so in a manner by lifting people up to a higher level of consciousness, namely Krishna consciousness. So their fixation on everything that's wrong suggests that they're not Krishna conscious. They don't seem to talk very much about Krishna, or even about Prabhupada for that matter. So it's another example of a mode of ignorance approach. And the result of that is that many people who start taking interest in Krishna consciousness lose it. They think, oh, I'm not getting into this, this is too much. So even though many of their some of their points may be valid, but their whole attitude is just it's one of destruction rather than construction. So that's another example of how of unhelpful preaching. Problems should be dealt with, no doubt. Constructive criticism, but only this is wrong, this is right. It doesn't, even if all their points about all the problems in ISKCON were true, and many of them are, but even if it were true, although some of the things they say are just ridiculous. I mean, really. They had a whole article criticizing Loknath Maharaj for he held a Bhagavad Saptaha, and then afterwards sold so many sets of Prabhupada. After people had come in and listened for 7 days, many of them bought full sets of Bhagavatam. That's a great achievement, isn't it? And he signed books for people, and they made a whole issue out of how he's signing the book. How can he dare to do that? It's not his book, it's Prabhupada's. But if the people feel they're getting Prabhupada's disciples' blessing, and they feel more encouraged to buy the book, and why? What's the harm? It's simply unnecessary fault find. The great thing he did, that thousands of people came to listen to him expounding the Bhagavatam, and then so many of them bought sets, full sets of Bhagavatam. They don't see that. They can only point out some fault, which is not even a fault, it's just an imagined fault. It's not a fault at all. So this is an example of misplaced criticism.
Mm-hmm.
But then it is a failure. But just like the other night, the last time I got heavy with someone was at that meeting in King's Cross. Who was that? You were there? No. Just a few nights. Were you there, Gary Dan? No. Well, there's some guy who apparently comes here every time and always says something pseudo-intellectual and stupid. You know who that is? Yeah. So after he'd given his question come comment, he'd spoken for about 2 minutes. I spoke strongly with him. What should I do? I mean, the man is a rambling so-called intellectual. What do? Engage in trying to mollify his stupid so-called... He doesn't know what he's talking about at all. So I would suggest that you either don't listen to his... Or if he does, just, you know, tell him he's a nonsense again and again and again. And he'll keep on coming because he loves prasada. And, you know, you don't have to spend a long time, just 2 or 3 minutes, point out how he's a nonsense, and then, you know, get on with the rest of the program, which is what I did. So, but I was heavy with him. I told him in a strong voice, you don't know what you're talking about. Einstein never, he was quoting Einstein, he said, you don't know, Einstein never said that.
How we can do this type of challenges without involve emotions?
Emotions must be there. Srila Prabhupada became angry because he loved Krishna. And he didn't like to hear people pompously rejecting Krishna and Krishna's understanding. Prabhupada got angry because he was involved emotionally. If you love Krishna, then you can't just say, well, that's a good idea. That's an interesting theory when someone says that everything is all one and there's no supreme God. You're going to get emotionally involved. That's nonsense. That's rascaldom. You say, that's an interesting theory. It's not an interesting theory. It's rascaldom. It's a direct expression of envy for Krishna. So a devotee will get angry. And that's this idea that we shouldn't get emotionally involved, that's another kind of impersonalism. We don't lose, shouldn't lose control.
There's the problem that sometimes the emotion kind of take you out of the of your focus and you end saying something.
No, the point is that a devotee is always thinking how to please Krishna and serve Krishna. So he doesn't lose control because he's always there. Just like Hanuman, he burned Lanka. That was a tremendous act of aggression, wasn't it? To burn. But he did restrain himself, thinking that, well, I've got to leave something for Ram to do too. He didn't. He could have killed everyone in Lanka just by himself, but he thought that, well, that wouldn't be good. I have to. Ram himself has vowed to rescue Sita, and so I'll leave something for Ram too. He was Krishna conscious about it. Actually, he was regretful that the fire could get out of control, and then even Sita could be burned. I never thought, but fortunately, that didn't happen. The Ashok Grove was far enough away. Actually, you know, we're discussing this point in such detail, but it's a natural thing. It's not that we have to each time apply some kind of mathematical principles. It comes naturally to one who is preaching. You'll find Vishnu Jan, he is lauded as being such a sweet preacher, but it's also told that when they were distributing prasadam, I think it was in the campus, University of California campus at Berkeley, and some shopkeepers, people brought in trailers they had licenses to sell food, and they were trying to stop it. Then they were getting aggressive, and then Vishnu Jan, he got a big stick and said, and faced them, said, "Stand and fight, dog." So he's ready to fight. Also, what is it that's described about Lord Rama, that he is what is that? Kusam api kamol and vajra api kator. No, exactly, that's not the right Sanskrit. Kusam api kotorani is the word. He says he's soft as a lotus and hard as a thunderbolt, according to the need, what's needed to serve Krishna.
What happens when one devotee's service interrupts another devotee's service?
What happens when one devotee's service interrupts another? Then hopefully there should be some mutual understanding. If personal ambition enters, that's also not good. This is my service, and even though I can't do it very well, no one else should interfere. Although sometimes Prabhupada would allow a devotee to do a service less perfectly than others could do, just to have them do some service. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, some of his disciples, they were making collection for building a new mutt, and one man gave a big donation, like a lakh of rupees, which in those days was a huge amount. And Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati said, well, that's good, but it would have been better if a lakh of people had each given 1 rupee each, so they all got the chance to serve. There's no fixed formula. You can't say in any specific situation, this is the way it should be done. You have to see each circumstance. What are your other questions? Let's do them quickly.
One question is about deity worship. Prabhupada would sometimes say that...
Gaur Nitai can be worshipped just with kirtan. That's true. There are minimum standards, but then if we're devotees, we should try to... Worship means to worship as nicely as possible, doesn't it? So instead of always looking for the minimum way to do things, we should think how to... Prabhupada said that in the Gaur Nitai dolls, but that's... They can be distributed as dolls, good luck dolls, but that's not meant for devotees. That you just keep them, you just keep them and you don't do anything. The idea is that they start off thinking of them as dolls, and then you take direction from devotees gradually how to worship them. So if we're always looking, some groups say you can chant 4 rounds. I'm always trying to look for what's the minimum we can get away with and still get Krishna praying. But then it doesn't work like that, though. By chanting Hare Krishna, Krishna reveals himself to us. So if we chant less, that means that if we're looking for some shortcut, that means we're not really looking to surrender to Krishna. Is it okay to drink decaffeinated coffee and denatured alcohol, denatured spirits? Can I enjoy sense gratification and also be Krishna conscious? No. Is it all right? Is it breaking the principle? It might not be breaking the principle of taking intoxication, but how does it help us develop Krishna consciousness? It's all this kind of thought is, how can I do the minimum, enjoy sense gratification to the max, and also, what's the limit that I can, how can I get as much sense gratification as possible and still be Krishna conscious? But the answer is zero. We have to tend towards zero sense gratification, not as much as possible, and still be Krishna conscious. Well, the whole endeavor, the whole thought is not conducive to Krishna consciousness. Yes, what's another one?
No, I just wanted to ask that on this basis they introduce it also to uninitiated devotees, that the only time worship is that in this sense...
Well, it's an uninitiated devotees to worship Gaur Nitai, well, that was never the standard given by Srila Prabhupada for devotees, and nor in the tradition. Deity worship means it's quite a commitment. Yeah.
He did give that instruction, didn't he, to Dhananjaya?
To make Gornitai dolls, yeah, for distribution to non-devotees, and then they could gradually come up. That was the idea, they should gradually come up. Not that devotees keep Gornitai dolls and go down. It's like... it's just like... If we ask one devotee, here's an initiated devotee, how many rounds are you chanting daily? Two. I say, oh, well, that's terrible. You're already about to chant 16, how are you only chanting two? But then you meet someone else and you ask them, how many rounds are you chanting? And they say, two. Oh, that's very good, that's great. Because they weren't chanting at all before. So there's... Yeah, okay. And something else? You had one other question?
I just don't understand this one statement here that the Vedas, Prabhupada, so what are the Vedas?
Oh, all kinds of knowledge are Veda.
Yeah, any knowledge you accept is Veda, for the teachings of the Vedas are the original knowledge. So I just like to hear some explanation.
I'll read that out again. Veda means knowledge. Any knowledge you accept is Veda, for the teachings of the Vedas are the original knowledge. Yeah, so if anything's actually true, what it means is anything actually is true, it's not outside the scope of the Veda. It doesn't mean that Dublin is the capital of Ireland can be found in either Rig, Sama, Yajur or Atharva Veda. It doesn't mean that. But facts about the universe, just like we'll find within the Vedic knowledge, there's medical knowledge, there's cosmological knowledge, there's knowledge of language, the principles of language. So anything which is knowledge, which are principles of the universe, not temporary changeable things, just like Dublin is the capital of Ireland, It's a temporary. It's a fact. It's knowledge to say that, but it's temporary because Ireland's temporary and Dublin's temporary, and Dublin may not always be the capital of Ireland. It wasn't until 1917 or something. London was the capital of Ireland at that time. But all those principles are within the Veda. Within the broader knowledge of the Veda. And just etymologically, Veda means knowledge. So, in that sense, any knowledge may be called Veda. What we have, the Vedic knowledge that we have at present is what is extant at the present time in human society is much less than was... Than the actual Vedas in present Kali Yuga. It's what is there is much less than was formerly there in human society. So any actual knowledge can be found in the Vedas. So if one comes to that by any method, then it's also Veda.
But that wouldn't apply to, for example, modern education and theories, scientific theories.
That's not knowledge, is it? It's not really knowledge. Yeah, means that which is fixed. So that's what I'm saying. This psychology, it's not. It can't really be called knowledge. It can be called a speculative system, but it can't really be called knowledge.
What about what they call practical knowledge? You know, science, like technology, how an engine works or something like that.
How an engine works, is it part of the Vedic knowledge? No, it won't be there. But the principles underlying it will be there. Apparently there's one branch of knowledge in the Vedic law, you could say, L-O-R-E, which is called Yantra Vidya, but that's meant for the demons. Knowledge of machines. technology. But the principles underlying it, mathematics, physics, that's all part of the Vedic law. Much has been lost. Otherwise we see in Delhi, even today, there's a pillar which has been, it's iron, which has been standing for hundreds of years. And one thing is that it never rusts. And only iron which is completely pure can do that. And that's only theoretical knowledge for modern scientists, because they can't make 100% pure iron. But that's pure iron. It hasn't rusted even slightly. Another thing is that it stands. It's not fixed. It just stands. So, there are many things which are... There are many technological marvels which people nowadays have no idea. They don't know how the pyramids are built. No idea. They couldn't reproduce them if they tried. So there is much high-level technological knowledge which is of a level higher than is presently extant, that was there in the Vedic knowledge and the Vedic culture and in other cultures also. Of course, that was all coming from the Vedic culture. It's an interesting statement, huh? It opens up a whole world that all knowledge is Veda. It opens up a whole world of understanding. That's what I'm saying, commentaries on Prabhupada's books, just that one statement, and one could write a few books just based on that one statement to demonstrate the point. Yeah.
In that regard, Maharaj, you were saying that Srila Prabhupada's purports for some have become something that anyone can...
Yeah, just like the Mayavadis, they take Bhagavad Gita and then they say, well, anyone can interpret it in any way they like. So that's there in our modern ISKCON society. Some people say that, well, you know, it's just anyone can interpret it any way they like. Yes, then.
So the other thing you mentioned about understanding or explaining those purports as it is. So it seems that a lot of devotees, maybe they've lost faith in leaders' qualifications, or you know, disciples or followers of Prabhupada. There's a lot of faith being lost. So yes. they're suspicious of anyone claiming to be able to explain Prabhupada's comments.
Yeah, they've lost their faith. It means they've lost bhakti, actually. That no one can explain Prabhupada, and anyone's opinion is as good as anyone else's. Then there's no bhakti, actually. If you think no one is qualified to understand or explain it, that means that it's not knowledge at all. Yeah, loss of faith means you lose everything. What is that? What is it? Vinashati. Oh. Sanshayatma Vinashati. One who doubts is finished. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita. So it may not seem to be very, very good faith to believe in anyone. So then the idea is that, well, you just believe in Prabhupada, but then you believe in your own mind, actually, because you give your own interpretation. And what happens, unless one is guided in spiritual life, then the tendency to reinterpret the text according to one's preconceptions, which are based on sense gratification, that's what happens. That's why what goes on in the name of Christianity is so different to what Jesus taught. And even there are churches, the whole Protestant ethic is one on work hard and God will reward you with wealth, which is exactly opposite to what Jesus said. But somewhere in our heart, a large chunk of the Christian world is based on this total reinterpretation of what Jesus said. And they're convinced it's true. I believe in the Bible. These are the Bible bashers. Because you start off with what you want to believe, and then you read what you want to believe, and you don't see what you don't want to believe. In ISKCON today, we're embarrassed by the statement that Prabhupada several times made that women are less intelligent. It's like taboo to say this, but Prabhupada does say it several times in his books, and you can't avoid it. Of course, that's what they wanted to annotate and this and that. Yes, it should be explained, but it shouldn't be dropped altogether. As if it, just like the Christians, they just don't discuss or think about the fact that slavery is accepted within the Bible. Slaves are discussed, and it's just considered. St. Paul says you should treat your slaves nicely. So it's something that they prefer not to think about. Of course, we don't accept the Bible as being gospel truth. So, but there is, I mean, the system of Shudras, it is almost tantamount to slavery, actually. They weren't free to just go here and there and do whatever they like. They were controlled. So there are many things which, I mean, why this one issue they want to comment on? That's what I'm saying. All of Prabhupada's books and everything he taught, it should be explained, because there are so many things. Prabhupada was for capital punishment. He was against democracy. And there's so many things that Prabhupada said which are definitely not politically correct.
Just on that point, I didn't have the chance to confirm this, but someone sent me a quotation from Prabhupada. I don't know if it's true or not, but maybe you can say something about it. That he said that the blacks in America should never have been given freedom.
He didn't exactly say that, but more or less he did say that. He said that the slaves, actually they were happy. I can't also remember, but more or less something like that. He said that the slaves, they were happy. They were looked after. They worked and they were fed and they were looked after. So that's like Shudras. Whereas the freedom, and then they in many cases they became drunkards. And actually, many of the slaves didn't want to be freed. They thought, what am I going to do, you know? I here I'm working and I have my master who looks after me and feeds me and gives me, and I'm going to be free. What am I going to do? All of a sudden, you don't have a home, you don't have food, clothing. They didn't want to be freed, many of them, but they were forced to be freed.
South Africa is a good example of it, under apartheid. Now they got rid of apartheid. It's like parts of it are just.
In some places,
that was a murder.
Yeah.
And I think so many people living there, so many of the Africans, much preferred.
They preferred it under apartheid, in which they were controlled. Yeah, because they're not developed culturally to be free. Freedom means to have a high level of freedom means that you're expected to use that responsibly. Many of them are not culturally developed enough for that. Here's a really politically incorrect statement coming up from me. Now, if we say that blacks, whatever the word, the popular word is now, they keep on trying, the Afro-Americans or whatever. What do they call them in Africa? Africans. But then South, white, African people, they're also African. Anyway, let's just say blacks.
More African.
Hmm?
More African. More.
Yeah, well, black wouldn't be, if you say African, that's also not correct, because there are many Arabs, for instance, who are Africans, or not black. Anyway, if we say that in general they tend to have strong bodies, they're good at sports, they're good at music and dancing, would anyone disagree with that?
They don't eat so much food either.
Is it? Yeah. So they're physically, they're very, you know, they're very... Or if we say that the Jews are very intelligent people and expert in making money, and many of them are comedians, entertainers, all this kind of things. So by saying that, indirectly, you're saying that other races are inferior in that respect. That the indirectly, you're saying that other races are less intelligent than the Jews, or other races are less physically developed than the blacks. But if you say that the blacks, for instance, are less intelligent, more prone to crime, and ugly, then you know, it'll be an uproar. You'll be in prison, probably.
On the point of ugly, someone could argue that, well...
It's all... Subjective. Well, yes, it's subjective. But actually, Prabhupada said that also. All right, let's say that they're less intelligent and less cultured and more prone to crime, which no doubt there are some very intelligent black people, and at least two of them became prominent leaders in our ISKCON society. But in general, it seems that they tend to be the ones, despite years of... Well, you could say they're discriminated against, but they do have the chance to come up, but not many of them do. Many of them... So anyway, I'm just making the point that this... Prabhupada spoke, he spoke clearly, and many of the things he said are not considered proper to say, but... Modern society has this very false idea of equality. Everyone's equal. No one really believes it, it seems, at least not in the case of race. I'm going to finish now, because you know what? There's a time and a place for everything, and it's, for me, time for prasadam. I try to keep regulated. So, Hare Krishna. And thank you for not throwing me out of the window. It's very, very polite of you.
We've got you recorded.
Yeah, I'm recording myself. I don't mind to distribute it either, because, you know, I've been thrown out of quite a few windows, or not allowed in them. But, you know, I will go on speaking like this, and if anyone wants, they can listen. If not, they can pull out the rotten tomatoes and, you know, do what they like. But I don't want to... compromise, I think it'll be, especially for sannyasis, it's just to become watered down. What's the point? Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna.